One, I'd like to convene the June 26th, 2017 meeting of the Subcommittee on Natural Resources of Joint Ways and Means. We have a couple of hearings today. I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2296. Mr. Stainer.
Thank you, Chair Witt. House Bill 2296 increases the amount of surety bond or letter of credit required to be filed with the Water Resources Commission by a licensed water well constructor from $10,000 to $20,000, and the bill also increases the amount of surety bond or letter of credit required by non-licensed persons constructing a water well on property that they own from $5,000 to $10,000. In addition, it increases the permit fee for those persons from $25 to $500. And removes the provision requiring a permit by those persons only when constructing, altering, or converting a well by means of a well drilling machine.
Okay.
Did you make that a work session as well?
Not yet.
Okay.
So do we have a sign-up sheet? All right, thank you very much. I'd like to call up, please, Raquel Lancier. Oh, and I guess you were bringing some folks up with you, too. I'm sorry. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, co-chairs, members of the committee. For the record, Raquel Rancier, Senior Policy Coordinator with the Oregon Water Resources Department. I have with me here today Chris Bird, who is the manager of our well construction and compliance section. So he'll handle any of the hard technical questions, but I'll do an introduction to the bill here. So House Bill 2296 is a bill that will help support the Oregon Water Resources Department's well construction program. The department is responsible for administering well construction standards as well as licensing well drillers and administering landowner permit applications for those individuals that choose not to use the expertise of a licensed well driller. This bill today addresses two provisions related to our well construction program. The first one is relating to bond requirements, and the second one is related to the landowner permit application fee. The well construction program is important to protecting the groundwater resource from waste and contamination. When we talk about waste, we're referring typically to commingling of aquifers, and that's where potentially a well can serve as a conduit for water that's in an upper aquifer to drain down through that well into other parts of different aquifers. So that obviously can pose a problem for individuals that are relying on that as a source. It can also be a conduit for contamination. So having a good well construction program that can be able to ensure that we're protecting the resource is important in the state for all those individuals that are relying on that source of water. So the bonding requirements currently are when you go to drill a well, either the well driller submits a bond or has a bond, and then if you're doing your own well, the landowner that chooses not to use the expertise of a licensed well driller, that landowner will have to post a bond as well. So currently the standards are for well drillers, it's $10,000, and that covers all of the wells that they drill. This proposes to increase it to $20,000, and again, that covers all the wells that they work on. And then for the landowner that chooses not to use a licensed well driller, we're proposing to increase it from $5,000 to $10,000. And this is because really the current requirements don't really cover even one well if we need to do repairs on it or if repairs need to be addressed. So that's the first provision of this bill. The second provision of this bill relates to the landowner permit application. So this is individuals that choose to drill their own wells or construct their own wells, modify, alter, or abandon wells. And this addresses really that they'll come to the department and they will submit a landowner permit application. Currently, that application cost is $25, and it hasn't been raised since the 1980s. And that really doesn't cover a lot of the work that we do. We estimate that the costs actually associated with processing these permits and assisting these landowners that choose not to use the expertise of a driller is between $500 and actually $3,000. So we're proposing today to increase that fee as well to a minimum of the $500, which is what it takes for us to process these applications and assist those landowners so that we're protecting the resource for all the users that are relying on that source. We're also proposing to remove the requirement that a well or that the landowner permit application fee also will apply to individuals that use hand tools. So currently that landowner permit application only applies when they are using a well drilling machine. So this would actually propose to expand that requirement to include those individuals that are constructing a well with hand tools. So with that, we think that these are good measures to continue to protect the resource, and we urge your eye support.
Thank you very much. Subcommittee members, Representative Esquivel.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Please explain to me a little bit more about this process, because I know you don't have someone stuck in the back of the room behind a door waiting for somebody to come in to get a permit so you can pay them. They're on the payroll at all times. That's what we pay our taxes for. Why do we have to spend an additional $500 to get a permit to drill a well on our own property?
Co-chairs and Representative Esquivel. So the landowner permit application process goes above and beyond what if an individual were to go through a licensed well driller. So we review it for completeness and accuracy when they submit the application. We then verify ownership and location information. We review the site conditions and write the permit and help fill out other parts of the paperwork that they have to complete. And then we visit the site throughout their work. So we're monitoring their progress. And then we also observe the seal placement. So that's, again, to make sure that they're doing it right. And then we'll conduct a final inspection and create the final paperwork and file. And so through this process, if we, well drillers have an understanding of well construction standards, and we often find that when a landowner chooses to undertake this activity themselves, we really have to tutor them in that. So that's why we're proposing an increase in this fee. To your point, we do have people on staff, and they're supported both by start card fees or funds as well as general funds, my recollection. But certainly this is an activity that goes above and beyond, and this will continue to help support that program.
What about this $10,000 to $20,000 on a, evidently that's a performance bond of some kind or some kind of an insurance bond. Well, is there some kind of a screaming outcry about this in the state of Oregon that there's something wrong?
Co-chairs and Representative Esquivel, this will help when there is an issue with how a well is constructed. This will assist with being able to repair that well or take remedial actions to address the issue with that well. So in some cases, it has to be abandonment. And so what we've heard is that this isn't really sufficient to typically cover those costs. The costs can't exceed the bond that's been posted. So this is all that the landowner themselves or the department, it's usually would be the landowner, I think, that's pursued this, that would go after that bond and try to recover those costs.
Thank you.
Raquel, before we leave that, could you perhaps describe a couple of examples of some things that could potentially go wrong with well drilling in terms of maybe imperiling the health or safety of others or the aquifer itself?
Chair Witt, I will pass that over to Chris here to discuss.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. So my name is Chris Bird. I'm the manager of the well construction and compliance section of the department. When a well constructor constructs a well, they're required to place an annular seal around the casing. If you could visualize the casing as a pipe in the ground, around the outside of the pipe would be the soil typically. But when they construct a well, they put cement or another sealing material there to keep any kind of conduit, any kind of contamination, to close that conduit. Anything that could potentially get to the aquifer to contaminate it, we want to close off. In addition, a driller may intersect multiple aquifers when they're drilling a well. And so we want to make sure that they're only getting water from one aquifer. And the annular seal is meant to shut off any other aquifers that another person could be using, potentially a landowner, irrigators, or anybody else, so that they're not basically allowing that aquifer to go dry. So keep them in one aquifer, close contaminant conduits, and just make sure that they don't, you know, become that conduit for contamination. And it happens more frequently with landowner constructed wells without supervision than typically with drilled wells by licensed drillers. You know, they have more of an idea of what they're doing since they're licensed. But yeah, we just want to make sure that any well that's constructed doesn't become a conduit for contamination.
Thank you, Representative Esquivel.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. How do you know about the aquifers in the ground? How do you know that?
Representative Esquivel. Most of the time we know. We have groundwater scientists, our groundwater people at the department, hydrogeologists, that study particular areas around the state, and they have a good idea based on previous drilling what they would encounter when they're drilling a well. We also know based on what the drillers encounter when they're actually on site constructing the well. They're logging the materials they're drilling through as they're drilling that well. And so we determine how they're supposed to construct that well as they encounter it, basically, or as they're drilling it. That way we can shut off any of the aquifers that they're accessing that they're not going to be taking, so that they're only taking water from their target aquifer.
Please.
So your people stand there and monitor what they're pulling out of the ground?
Representative Esquivel, we do have well inspectors that visit the sites. They're typically not on site during the whole construction process. But generally, especially with the permitted well, the department does consult with drillers on the construction of the wells just to make sure that they're meeting any kind of conditions that are in the permit that they're required to meet. And with landowner-constructed wells, we do have the inspectors, again, that visit the sites as they're constructing them. Typically, they may go after, but we also will review well reports that the drillers submit to make sure that they meet construction standards.
Representative Lewis, did you have something?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is a pretty steep increase going from 25 to 500. Have the landowners been involved in this discussion? Are they aware that this may be coming?
Co-chairs and Representative Lewis, when we start our legislative concept development, we certainly interact with all of the various stakeholder groups that typically represent landowners. So to target a specific landowner group, that's a challenge because we only get about 15 to 40 of these a year on the landowner permit application. So they're not as frequent. Folks typically choose to utilize a well driller, so these are fairly rare. That said, of course, these have been out, for the public. We haven't heard anything on that front, but certainly we do consult with various water user groups that do include, landowners, but there's no easy way to target a specific landowner group, I suppose.
Representative Power.
Yeah, thank you. To Representative Lewis's point, I was wanted to follow up about proportionality. How much does it usually cost to drill one of these wells?
Co-chairs and Representative Power. It's difficult to assess when an individual is doing the work themselves. But what we do know is that generally to construct a well, if it's a domestic exempt well, shallow well, That's typically around $15,000. If you're getting up to a more complex and deep irrigation basalt well, then that's around $180,000.
Okay, thank you.
And can you give us an idea of what range of costs we might be looking at to mitigate a mistake that was made with a well contamination or whatever?
Chair Witt, members of the committee, that's difficult to say. Generally, and Chris, I'll let you chime in here on this. Correct me if I'm wrong. But so typically the first step is really to address the well that's the challenge. So that would be either requiring repair or modification to that well, or sometimes that's not possible, and that does require then abandonment of the well. Now, obviously, if you've had commingling of the aquifers, for example, you know the aquifer is already drained down into another aquifer, and so the ability to remediate that, you know, you can't get the water back up to the higher aquifer. So that's a challenge there. From a contamination standpoint, it's just going to vary depending on what the issue is, I think. And
that's correct. Yeah, I mean, basically, Co-Chair Witt, we're just trying to stop the problem from getting worse. So when we do come across a well that's potentially contaminated in an aquifer, we'll want to fix the problem. There's not a lot of ways we can treat the groundwater that's already been contaminated, but we'll treat the problem by either fixing the well or permanently having it decommissioned or abandoned by a licensed driller, so that the problem doesn't get worse.
So, in order to give this subcommittee some kind of yardstick by which we can determine the potential fairness, if you will, of both a permit as well as a fine relative to what the damage is that could potentially be done, can you assist us with that?
Co-Chair Witt, are you asking about the cost to clean up an aquifer after it's been contaminated?
You have a bill here that's increasing your fees substantially. You have heard a number of questions from this subcommittee so far that suggests that is a rather large increase percentage-wise. That is probably true. To place that in context, could you help us understand, in relation to potential damage that's out there, what would the fees and the penalties be in terms of potential damages?
Chair Witt, members of the committee, I think I understand what you're getting at, and I don't know that I'll have a answer for you today on that front. I think what we've looked at is that, one, this fee has not been increased since the 80s, and that does explain in part the proposed increase here. Two, when you do think about the need for repairing or replacing a well, those costs are significantly higher, and so we've looked at it from that individual basis. Being able to assess how this would impact and what the costs would be either associated with cleanup, for example, that's going to be a challenge because it's going to be very fact-specific.
Sure.
And so the costs would be, how far – what other wells are in the system? Is it confined to only this landowner's system, or has the issue spread farther? So those are all factors to consider. In terms of, again, the issue with commingling of aquifers, we have seen an area where there's been this challenge that's been in the Mosier area. The legislature has authorized, it was in 2015, $1 million to assist with repairing those wells. And those wells, the issue out there is commingling. So that would be where, and that's in part because there's very complex geology that has led to the challenges out there. So that's an example. I think we're estimating around there that the repairs may be around $40,000 per well.
All right. Thank you very much. Representative Esquivel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. How many of these do you have a year? And my other question is, you say it's around $40,000, but that would vary with the geographical area. It would vary with the water tables. And I guess my question is, if it was certified, what part does the department play in to prevent that?
Co-chairs and Representative Esquivel. So the $40,000, that's an example from a particular geology. So that's absolutely correct. It will vary based on the geology. In an area that has much more simple geology, it may not be as much of a challenge to address the issue. The Mosier example is certainly a complex case. And I'm sorry, I don't remember your other question.
Well, my question is, how would you, being permitting of people, how would you prevent that in the first place?
Co-chairs and Representative Esquivel, I think, you know, obviously this is a challenge across the state. The way that we try to address this up front is by, one, having licensed well drillers. Those well drillers are required to take a test to meet certain standards, and then they're also required to have continuing education. So that is one way to do that, is by having an educated well drilling community that understands what they're coming across when they're drilling, and being able to assess the situation and understand what the well construction standards are. And that is why it does take us, as part of being proactive, we do a lot of work up front with these individual landowners that aren't using the expertise of a well driller. At the end of the day, as you're pointing out, I think it will be a challenge. We can't prevent every scenario that could potentially come across, because we are dealing with a resource that is underground that we can't directly see.
Thank you. Anyone else? Representative Helm.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just again for context, since we're talking about the number of self-dug or self-drilled wells every year, do you have an estimate of the total number of wells that are the new wells that are new or replacement, I guess, wells?
Co-chairs and Representative Helm. So if you're talking about the landowner drilled ones, we get about 15 to 40 of these applications a year. If you're talking about individuals that choose to use hand tools to construct their own well, there's been no requirement in the past to come to the department, so we would have no way of determining how many are out there or how many are proposed each year.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Please.
And then the second part of my question, I'm sorry I didn't articulate it well, was just of all the wells, domestic water wells that are either drilled new or are replacement by certified well drillers, what are we looking at? What's the number looking at there?
Co-chairs and Representative Helm, it's roughly around 2,000 to 3,000. So it's going to vary based on the economy and all those factors. But yeah, roughly around 2,000 to 3,000.
All right. Anything further before we dismiss this panel? Thank you both very much. Appreciate it. I'd like to call up Jerry Schmidt, please.
What are you going to do, Bob? Dig a well?
Not me. That's what I was thinking.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. My name is Jerry Schmidt. I'm here today representing the Oregon Groundwater Association. We included in our members as the licensed well constructors. And it's a very pleasure to be here, because this is my final testimony before the Legislative Assembly, and I'm just ducky, I feel real well. So, Tito, you guys are feeling pretty good, too, because it's getting towards the end of the session, and pretty soon you guys will get to go home, so that'll be very, very welcome, I'm sure. The only brief comment I had was the department has kind of clarified it in their well construction and bond requirements in their public testimony here. And I'll repeat it. It says the department has spoken with the Oregon Groundwater Association and agreed to require the increased bond requirements for drillers at the time the license is renewed. The issue to us was our licenses for drillers are renewed not from a specific date. In other words, it doesn't go to July to July. It depends on the individual driller. So by putting in this language, it clarifies that whenever the license comes up for renewal, then they have to meet these new debonding requirements, rather to try to get everybody to go back at a specific date and say, I want to increase my bond. It creates a real havoc for the industry to try and make all those corrections, as opposed to just making the change when the license comes up, they will increase their bonding requirements. And the other reason I just came up was if there was anything further that you guys wanted to ask, technically, I will try to give a reply with that. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions for Mr. Schmidt?
Thank you.
Jerry, thank you very much, and wish you the very best in your retirement.
Thank you very much.
Is there anyone else who would like to testify on House Bill 2296 today? I'm not seeing anyone. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2296 and open a work session.
Standardies for just one second.
Standardies.
Thank you.
We're back on the record. I don't know if I open that work session or not, but I am opening a work session on House Bill 2296. Committee members, before I recognize Co-Chair Frederick, is there any anyone have any questions or issues at this point? Not seeing anything. Co-Chair Frederick.
Chair Witt, I move Senate Bill 2296A to the full committee with a due pass recommendation.
That would be, Co-Chair Frederick moves House Bill 2296 to the full committee with a due pass recommendation.
Oh, I'm sorry. Just to clarify, Senator Frederick, this is House Bill 2296A. Is that your motion?
That's correct.
Okay, thank you.
As stated. Any discussion on his motion? I'm not seeing any. Would the clerk please call the roll?
No.
Senator Taylor?
Aye.
Senator Frederick?
Yes.
Representative Esquivel?
No.
Representative Helm?
Aye.
Representative Power?
Aye.
Representative Lewis?
No.
Representative Witt?
Aye. Having received the necessary majority, the motion passes. On the Senate side, Senator Frederick?
Me.
And Ways and Means.
Ways and Means.
I'm sorry. On the Ways and Means, thank you. And on the House side, let's see here.
I think the chair should take this one.
Yeah. When it comes, I will.
Question of the carrier.
Yes. Thank you very much. I'm looking forward to that. No. I'm fine. Thank you. Appreciate it. With that, I'm going to close the work session on House Bill 2296. Thank you, everyone. And open a public hearing on House Bill 2268. Mr. Stainer, please.
Thank you, Chair Witt. House Bill 2268 establishes a following fee schedule for each underground storage tank subject to permit requirements. This is an escalating fee schedule that begins at $195 for the calendar year 2018, $245 for the calendar year 2019, $295 for the calendar year 2020, and $325 for the calendar year 2021 and each subsequent calendar year after that.
Thank you. All right. We have signed up for testimony. Let's see. Let's call up Abby Boudouris and Mike Kortanoff from DEQ. And anyone else that you'd like to bring forward? Good afternoon.
Good Welcome. Afternoon. Thank you. Thank you, Co-Chair Witt and Co-Chair Frederick and members of the committee. I'm Abby Boudouris with the Department of Environmental Quality. I'm a legislative analyst there. I'm here today to briefly describe the DEQ underground storage tank program and to support House Bill 2268. Next to me here is Mike Kortanoff. He's the manager of the DEQ Regional Underground Storage Tank Inspection Program, or as it's commonly called, the UST program. I'll be providing the overall testimony, and Mike is sort of, he is the expert here to answer the hard questions. The most common underground storage tanks, or USTs, are where local gas stations store their fuel, although there are other uses. And until the 1980s, most USTs were made of bare steel and are likely to corrode over time and allow the contents to leak into the environment. Faulty installation or inadequate operation and maintenance procedures can cause the contents to leak and release into the environment. And the greatest risk of the leaking USTs is that the petroleum or other hazardous substances will seep into the soil and contaminate groundwater. And over half of Oregonians rely on groundwater for their drinking water. A leaking USTs can present other health and environmental risks, including the potential for fire and explosion. So in response to that program, in the 80s of leaks and contaminating groundwater, in the 80s, there were both federal and state laws that were passed requiring owners to upgrade their tanks and to maintain them. The DEQ program started in 1986 with the primary purpose of ensuring that those leaks do not occur, by ensuring proper operation of leak prevention equipment, such as corrosion prevention, spill prevention, and overfill protection, and leak detection systems. To pay for the program, that legislation required a per-tank fee. The legislature last increased that fee from $85 to $135 in 2007. Today, the program is unable to comply with the EPA-required compliance inspections or to align the Oregon rules with federal rules due to inadequate funding. The program can no longer afford two of the 5.5 full-time inspector positions, they are vacant, needed to implement the program. HB 2268 represents work by DEQ along with stakeholders and increases that per-tank fee from $135 to $325 over 4 years, beginning in January of 2018. The fact sheet that I submitted, it's posted on OLIS, shows the phase-in details, and you heard it from the LFO staff here. The fees pay for over half of the program costs, with federal grants paying the other about 45%. DEQ uses no general fund for this work. The proposed fee will allow us to restore those two inspector positions, get back into schedule of our inspections, and to do the rulemaking required by EPA. It will allow us to do the prevention activities, and that's really the key to this program. We'll be able to once again inspect once every 3 years, provide technical assistance to ensure the proper functioning of the underground storage tank systems. Importantly, verifying that owners have the financial assistance assurance in place to clean up contamination and to stay in business if a leak occurs. So House Bill 2268 will allow us to continue preventing and minimizing leaks impacting air, water, and land from underground storage tanks. Thanks for the opportunity to be here, and Mike and I are happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much. Subcommittee members, Representative Esquivel, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You mentioned that you had two vacant positions. How long have those positions been vacant?
Mike?
Co-chairs, Representative Esquivel. For the record, my name is Mike Kortanoff, Oregon DEQ. They went vacant through retirements, the first one in the fall of 2015 and the second one in the spring of 2016, so over a year to a year and a half.
Anyone else? I'm not seeing anything. Thank you very much. Appreciate your testimony.
Thank you.
I'd like to call up next, please, Tammy Denny and Amanda Dalton. Sorry, Danelle, you're going to have to do it alone. Good afternoon to both of you.
Good afternoon. Co-chairs and members of the committee, my name is Tammy Denny. I'm the legislative director for the Oregon Dairy Farmers Association. Thank you so much for being here today and for allowing me to offer testimony. The Oregon Dairy Farmers Association is headquartered here in Salem and represents 228 dairies statewide. 25 of those dairies are right here in Marion County. Our multi-generational farm families deliver the highest quality milk to the market every day under strict state and federal regulations. In 2015, the milk produced in Oregon's dairy farms resulted in an economic contribution of more than $474 million. The number of Oregon dairies is directly related to the ability of each farm to withstand milk market price fluctuation against the cost of feed, labor, taxes, equipment, and ever-changing regulatory burden from the state and federal levels. It is imperative any new fees, like the added burden of increased fees represented by House Bill 2268, to increase fees over time from the existing level of 135 to 325 by 2021 be thoroughly evaluated and the negative impacts considered. These same fees were increased from $85 to its current level of 135 in 2007, and my written testimony submitted to OLIS did represent an error and indicated 2013 was the last increase, so my apologies to the agencies for that error. It would seem that another increase this session may by very well be a little bit extreme in its ratchet from 135 to 325. The Oregon Dairy Farmers Association urges this committee use an abundance of caution regarding escalating fees at this level. Our producers are tightening their belts during this time of reduced milk prices when their cost of production exceeds the price they receive for their fluid milk. Thank you for considering the aggregated effects of increased fees, not only in this bill, but other bills that are being passed this session. The dairy producers do appreciate the opportunity to speak to the record. We appreciate our relationship with the agency and the issues and the perspective that they have raised, and we look forward to working with them going forward. So thank you very much. I will answer questions if you have any.
Thank you very much. Amanda?
Chair Witt, members of the committee, Amanda Dalton. I'm here on behalf of the Northwest Grocery Association, and we represent the majority of kind of your large fuel providers. We were active participants in the activity and the meetings over the summer and have been working on this with DEQ for about a year. Staff was very responsive. I think it's sometimes important in these discussions to know where we started. And I can tell you we started upwards of $2,000 fee increases. And so where we ended, we felt was pretty significant movement. Our members also believe that this fee was well worth the risk of having duplicative efforts, meaning having the federal and the state programs coming in to inspect, and that kind of surprise and not knowing who you're talking to and at what point. And so we were here, and we're here during the policy committee to support the proposed fee increase. We think it's a reasonable fee increase, and it's well worth the additional $50 per year, and just appreciate the department working with us over the summer.
Well, thank you very much. Appreciate that. Any questions or comments? Appreciate both of your testimonies and also working behind the scenes to hopefully find a bill that's going to work for everyone here. Danelle? Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, co-chairs and members of the committee. For the record, Danelle Romaine, representing the Oregon Fuels Association, and we are a statewide association of fuel retailers and distributors. And kind of echoing what Amanda Dalton said, we were also part of that advisory committee looking at the increased fees. We were very impressed with the outreach from the DEQ over the interim and their ability to work with us on what we believe is a reasonable fee increase to meet a federal mandate. So we are in full support of 2268, and we thank you for your consideration.
Thank you. Anything for Ms. Romaine? Thank you very much. Appreciate your testimony. Thank you for your work over the summer, and everyone's comments about the help that they receive from the DEQ staff is greatly appreciated, and I'm sure the department appreciates it as well. Anyone else wishing to testify today on House Bill 2268? Last and final call. Once, twice, three times. Going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2268. Mr. Stainer, what do we have for coming events here in the foreseeable future?
Fireworks.
Nothing at all.
Chair Witt, members of the committee, you do have some items that are posted on a list, I believe, through Wednesday. We've got some, maybe even through Thursday now. We have some. The schedule is very fluid, so I'm not going to go into each thing in detail. We have a great deal of work that the subcommittee is going to be expected to do this week, and I will make a notation that it may be that if we run out of time on any given day in our allotted afternoon time slot, we may recess to just to afford a floor session and actually come back in the evening to complete our work. We really have too full of a schedule to carry things over into another day. Uh-huh. So we need to do each day's work each day, and that may require two sessions.
Thank you for that. I appreciate it. Anyone else? Any announcements? Good of the order?
I think we should initiate the 10-word rule.
The 10-word rule, which is?
Which is when you call upon someone, they only have 10 words to explain themselves.
There we go. Can we make that applicable to the House?
Just disconnect the microphones there.
With that, I'm going to adjourn the June 26th meeting of our subcommittee. Thank you, subcommittee members. Thank you, subcommittee members. June 26th meeting of our